I'm Ellen Mary.
And I'm Michael Perry.
And he's a plonky.
And she's a plant addict.
And this is the Plant-Based Podcast.
This is more than just a gardening podcast. We'll be exploring the world of plants from every possible angle. We'll be talking about plant-based diets, plant materials and fabrics, the well-being qualities of plants, and giving plenty of gardening tips and tricks.
So we'll be chatting worldwide to companies and individuals that are being creative with plants in new and exciting ways, from fabulous flower crowns to foliage-filled lounges,
botanical moisturizers to bamboo clothing.
It's all here.
And it's all made of plants.
Sutton's, suppliers of gardening products since 1806, sponsor the Plant-Based Podcast. Visit them online at suttons.co.uk.
So today we find ourselves at Seedball HQ, don't we, with
very
Emily?
Very excited to be
it's
here.
Very exciting. Yay. It's kind of very industrious. There's Seedball tins everywhere and crates of Seedball. It's fantastic. And bee photos on the walls. Lovely. I've known you since you very first started Seedball. And it's always
like ages ago.
It does seem like ages ago. And I've always found what you do really interesting. And it's so unique, isn't it? Such a unique idea. When did it all start?
Oh, thank you. So we started, it was probably about 6 years ago. We were both studying conservation-related things at university. And we just really wanted to do something positive with our lives in terms of conservation. And we just felt a bit... We just weren't fulfilled in what we were doing. And so we were on the lookout to do something different. And we always liked the idea of running our own business and working for ourselves. And so we decided we wanted to set up a company that, in the long run, we wanted to be able to buy our own land and create our own wildflower meadows or wildflower reserves. And instead of being a charity, we decided that why don't we make a product that in itself is beneficial for wildlife. And in the long run, it will help us get to where we want to go to. So we got all very excited about this, and then we're like, oh, well, what's our product going to be? We're like, I'm not quite sure what to do. And then by chance, Anna, who I founded the company with, she did a permaculture course and came across the idea of Seedballs. Because it's using other materials to protect the seeds, so it's the idea that you don't need people to help.
So what actually is a Seedball?
So it's so doody. It's seeds mixed with clay, compost and chili powder. So you make it like a cake mixture. We kind of pour all the ingredients in, and originally we made it all by hand around a kitchen table. We got totally messy. It's brilliant. And so once the ball's dried, essentially the outer clay kind of creates this really hard casing, so it's really difficult for birds and insects to get at the seeds inside. So it's just all about trying to maximise as much as possible protection of the seeds.
And it makes it easy to sow as well, because literally
you scatter.
You use a catapult as well, right?
So we've got these gorgeous ones in at the moment, but handmade. They're quite good fun if you've got a really large space to kind of use them.
It's good fun for kids, isn't it?
It's really, really good. And there's just something about it. I think I didn't expect this, but I didn't appreciate just how... I mean, my background's not necessarily gardening. And to see a little shoot coming out the top of these little balls, there's just something really, really...
It's beautiful.
It's amazing. It's really exciting.
It's like a miracle, generally. That's what it looks like. That's how I feel about anything shoots. You know, it's like, wow, this is a miracle. This has happened, you know. Yeah. But seeing those little shoots come out, those tiny little seed balls, that's so cool.
It's a lot of fun. And that's why in general, you can use them anywhere in the garden that's on bare soil, but I really like using them in pots because you can track the progress much more easily.
That's cool.
So people,
Sorry, I diverted us a little bit there because I felt we needed to know what a Seedball is, but you've basically gone from kitchen table to small warehouse just 6 or 7 years. But tell us more about your real motivation behind creating this Seedball product, though. What is your kind of big master plan with everything?
So we see ourselves as... we want to help inspire people, really. We want to inspire more people to grow bee and butterfly-friendly wildflowers. So between habitat loss, climate change, agricultural practices, like the abundance and diversity of wildflowers is on the decline in the UK, and as a result, that has an impact on bee and butterfly populations. So with this, we kind of saw it as a way of saying, okay, so with this little product, we can actually... if we can use this to help inspire more people to get involved in growing these types of flowers in their gardens and balconies, then yeah, our kind of goal is to properly impact conservation.
And you clearly are doing that because, you know, you started, how many years ago was it?
So I think it was about, we first launched the tin in March 2013.
Okay. And you've recently moved, haven't you, into new premises. So the business is growing. So people must be feeling inspired by what you do.
I think we've sold about 2 million balls.
Wow.
There's 2 million seed balls out there.
Oh my gosh, so how many? So if you get like, I don't know, let's say 10 plants from each ball. Uh-huh. And you know, and then we were trying to work out how many plants a bee visits, you know, in terms of a day and things like that, then we're really chuffed. We love
That's
it. We
just cool.
We totally love what we do. This.
Wow. It's such so nice. A key part of conservation in the UK.
It is.
Wow. Yeah, and it's much better than sitting in a university kind of being, which is very, you know, good places
yes,
too.
Yes, of course. Yes.
But for us, it just feels very satisfying. And we really like engaging with people online as well, and we can see that people really, people get really enthusiastic about it, and people share photos, and there's a real love in. I think
it's fun. It's a little bit quirky. It's different. Even the packaging is different. The way you sell it is very different.
And it's really cool. So the packaging, the tin, is from. It's made by the last tin can maker in South London.
Okay.
Using Welsh tin, so it's all British. It's totally British sourced, which is cool because we're based in North London, so it's like a London mashup.
Yeah, a London mashup. We like that.
I love mashup. The sound of the balls in the tin as
well.
Yeah,
you can't help audio. It, can you? It's just like, out of all of those millions of seed balls that are out there, you have different varieties, don't you?
Yeah.
What do you have?
So our most popular ones are the bee mix and butterfly mix. So they're specifically for bees and butterflies in mind. But essentially, all of the different mixes we have, they're all kind of pollinator friendly.
Okay.
And we recently launched a set with the Natural History Museum, a bat mix, bird mix, and beetle mix.
Okay.
So it's kind of thinking not just about bees and butterflies in your garden, but other types of wildlife too.
Which is the most popular?
In general, it's the bee mix
okay.
and butterfly mix by far, but the bat mix is pretty wicked.
I think I'm going to have a go at the bat mix.
Yeah, do it. It's amazing.
We have bats in your garden. We have bats in our garden, and we've got this massive ivy, of course, which attracts the moths and birds. And in the summertime, the bats over the ivy are fantastic.
Wow, amazing.
So, I'd love to use that.
Have you got a bat detector?
I haven't. So
they're not too expensive. A bat detector.
Oh.
So they're not too expensive, and they kind of like will track, so it kind of makes little clicks, so you can kind of hear them. And on an evening in the summer, it's a really nice thing to do.
I guess bats always get overlooked in.
They
you know,
do
attracting
a bit, don't
pollinators
they?
And
but
you know,
they're really important.
Garden,
they're really important for creating biodiversity in our spaces. Oh. So it's really interesting. I've tried almost all of your seed balls, not all of them, but most of them. I've tried the herb mix as well, tea mix, the butterfly and bee, and I just don't think I've done the bat, so I'm going to have a go at that.
I want to ask kind of how do you put these balls together then? You must have fancy machinery to get through that 2 million seed balls. Or
we've got a semi fancy machine.
Okay.
There's still a lot of so we still have to.
It's still quite a hand job.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there's lots of cement mixers involved and. Well, not lots of cement mixing, but lots of cement mixing. We're not using a cement... We're not
an actual cement mixer,
no. It's a handheld cement mixer.
Okay, wow.
And, but we do. We've kind of... It's still pretty kind of small scale. But it's... it's a lot easier than doing it by hand.
So you basically mix up a big batch of seed ball dough.
Yeah,
pretty And then
much.
Make these balls... Yeah. And they're rolled by hand?
No, they're not rolled by hand.
Okay.
So we kind of prepare it all by hand, but then we chuck it through a machine, and we do about, makes about 6,000 balls at a time. It's quite long, long...
Did you engineer that machinery yourself? Or?
No. I would love to. One day, I think we need to.
It's fascinating.
Yeah, and people keep saying to us, you need to find like a clever way of kind of like measuring out the... Because at the moment, we have a whole team of people that kind of put labels on the tins and put the balls in, but of course not all the balls are perfectly round. And given it's called sea ball, kind of we need to make sure there's all kind of round balls that go inside it, so we had to kind of pick them out by hand. So one day people were saying, should get like a special machine that can kind of work all these things out, but I kind of like working with a big team of people. It's kind of nice too.
That's nice. You've got a nice kind of team environment here, and everyone's got the same end goal in mind, I guess, haven't they?
Emily said earlier the staff here are so happy, and I said, well, It's because you're a really nice boss.
Yeah. No, it's just a nice team of people. It feels like a family.
That's lovely. Seedball family HQ.
And we'd be nowhere without all these without the team and how it's kind of.
That's how good businesses run, isn't it?
It is, yeah. Treat your staff well and they will give you those results. Yeah. It's obvious, isn't it?
No, I need to shake a tin because I love the sign as well. I've obviously used these a fair bit. Also, we've used them at the community garden, and we've scattered loads in the community garden. We've got a huge wildflower meadow, which is all seedball, basically. It looks very beautiful. I just chuck them. Yeah. Is that the best way?
Essentially, yes, but be careful throwing them onto grass where it's quite hard for the wildflower to get established. The grass is so dominant. So it's better to kind of make the area bare.
So it's best to be on soil.
Or compost is fine too. Or in pots, in planters, window boxes. And then essentially just throw.
So they really don't need to be buried.
No, not
because they're protected in that ball.
They're essentially already planted.
Brilliant. So easy, isn't it?
The idea is you scatter them and you just leave them, and kind of nature does its thing.
So where would you stand on guerrilla gardening if someone sees an area in their neighbourhood that is a little bit kind of sparse? Could they throw seedballs on there and beautify it?
I don't know. In theory, I think you're supposed to have permission of whoever's space that is. So we kind of have pretty much just talk about people's garden.
We're keeping guerrilla gardening underground. So we're not saying go and do it, but we kind of are.
Yeah, I mean, and then they're very handy.
Put them in your pocket and accidentally drop them.
So we worked out that there's something like, if you add up all the people's back garden spaces together, it kind of makes a bigger area than like all of the UK's natural nature reserves or something like that together. So kind of a lot of our focus is on the fact that we've all got loads of space that we're not using that's actually available to us already that we're just not maximising. So kind of our mindset's very much about how do you maximise the space with where you are at the moment.
Fantastic.
And are they sold all around the world or just in the UK?
So mainly in the UK. We can't export them out of Europe just because all the seeds are naturally found in this part of Europe. So we don't really want to be introducing kind of, you know, very much just like native British flowers.
Native only. Oh, that's superb.
Brilliant.
I love this world of seedball and I've been a great supporter of you for many years. And yeah, it's great to find out more about the company and how it came from kitchen table to small warehouse. But in part two, we're going to find out about how you can use seed balls at home and interact with the nature in your outdoor space.
It's great to hear of a really inspirational business that's so ethical as well.
I know, I love what seed ball do, and I've been following them for quite a few years.
Me too.
It doesn't just look like a lovely gift item, but it's actually the gift that keeps on giving, because every year you're getting these beautiful patches of wildflowers in your garden with bees, butterflies, bats, moths as well. You know, a lot of those forgotten insects and creatures are also catered for, which is fabulous.
It is about promoting that biodiversity in a garden, and that's not just bees or butterflies, is it? That's everything. I mean, that includes all our insects and our hedgehogs, and it's everything. But those seed ball tins include so many native British wildflowers that's what they're aimed to do, is just to attract birds and bees and butterflies into the garden. I have used them quite a lot. I've used them in containers, so I've grown their salad mix, which is really good, although my rocket went to seed very quickly.
I didn't harvest it quick enough.
I didn't water it so much either.
But when it goes to seed, the flowers are lovely as well.
The flowers are really
edible,
pretty.
Peppery flowered.
Absolutely. And the herb mix was really good. Mm-hmm. Herb mix and tea mix. That's good.
Yeah,
you can make your own tea, which is really cool.
Creation there.
Yeah.
Beautiful. So in part two, we're going to look at how we can use wildflowers around our own outdoor spaces in order to attract all of those pollinating insects and also to attract beneficial insects, which will feed on all the nasty creatures in our gardens. So it's, you know, the food chain done right. So in part two of the podcast, we're going to look at how you can grow wildflowers and seed balls in your own outdoor space, whether that is in your garden, in your long grass, or even on the patio or a balcony. There is a seed ball for every part of your outdoor area. So, Emily, Tell us a bit more about what we can do in our gardens to promote biodiversity and where seed balls and the specific blends you've got come into that.
It's a big topic, yeah. Right?
Wildlife like piles of logs or long grass, as you
don't
say.
Don't be too tidy, is that what we're saying?
Yeah, so it's about not being too tidy. It's about... So with the wildflowers, it actually doesn't necessarily matter which ones you particularly grow. I mean, I know different wildflowers will grow in different types of areas according to soil conditions. So what we try and do with the different mixes that we have is each mix has got flowers that like slightly different types of conditions. Mm-hmm. So the idea is that wherever you use them, there'll be something that'll be well suited to where you've scattered them.
Okay.
Because the whole point is that we just want to grow, you know, some native wildflowers. Yeah. Specifically, that's which ones can, you know, some people have their favourite different types.
Yeah.
But in general, as a starting point, you know, some native wildflowers growing in your garden is just absolutely brilliant.
Okay, so that means that when you sow a seed ball, whatever type of soil you have in your garden, then some elements from that seed ball will grow there, which is brilliant, because then you really don't have to worry about your type of soil, which a lot of people get confused about, like, oh, I need to test my soil. Is it dry? Is it wet? Blah, blah, blah.
So, for example, in our butterfly mix, we've got purple loosestrife, and this really, really likes kind of wet, damp soils. Mm. We've got a spot near a pond.
Okay.
So there are, you know, sometimes people do come to us with specific, you know, this is what my garden's like, and we can make suggestions.
Uh-huh.
But in general,
But generally, the components are in there for a range of different conditions in a garden.
In theory. So we're trying to kind of, it's very hard to kind of create a foolproof seed product that is going to work every time. But the idea is we're just trying to maximise as possible the chance that that you'll
see.
I've used butterflies and bees together, so I've sprinkled them all together, chucked them, and I had a big patch at the back of my old garden, and it was oxeye daisy madness. Right, it was absolutely full. There's some achillea, some foxglove. I'm looking on the back of the tin now to remind myself. I had quite a lot of mallow. And
that's just gorgeous.
Oh, forget-me-nots, beautiful, loads of them.
Yeah.
And they would all flower at different times, but the oxeye daisies would last for months and months and months, and it looked absolutely extraordinary. Mm-hmm. I'd mow them back at the very late in the season, and then they would just grow again next year, and that was all from seed balls, and it was a huge patch of my garden.
Oh, amazing. Yeah, because we sometimes find that not all the seeds in each ball will germinate in the first year. So sometimes even with the annual species that you would assume you might have to re-sow the next year, I think what we find is you get regrowth from the original seed ball of kind of seeds that haven't germinated in the first year, and then they kind of
come back. That's really interesting. So you could get something exciting again the following year.
And it's really interesting. We noticed that there are certain flowers that seem to do especially well over other ones.
Okay.
So some years we get kind of years where the poppies seem to actually go crazy, or the oxeye daisies.
Generally, the climate, it might be that we have a warmer spring, or we've had a particularly cold winter. Mm. You know, it's just all of those different climatic conditions generally. Yeah. So in the mixes, you've got you know, your butterfly and bees, the ones that we'll focus on here. What are the best wildflowers for butterflies?
We spoke with the Butterfly Conservation Organisation, because they've got a really neat list of these are the flowers that we recommend for butterflies. Because of the size of our balls, we're a little bit limited in what seeds we can put in them, because we can't use really big seeds.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So essentially, we kind of like went for their list and we said, right, what should we go for from here? And again, we tried to pick out, you know, flowers that like slightly different environments.
Mm-hmm.
So we went for, so in our butterfly mix, we've got purple loosestrife, forget me not, yarrow, musk mallow, which is so gorgeous, and red campion, which I love too.
Cool.
So yeah, it's
and they're all brightly coloured and nectar rich, which is exactly what butterflies love, isn't
we
it?
We have so much fun. We have so much fun when we have a new mix and trying to work out how to choose them. And also we have to, the great thing with the butterfly flowers, they're all you've got to make sure they're easily accessible for those types of animals to actually get the pollen from.
Okay. And what about the bee mix?
So the bee mix we have, I just love it. So Viper's Bugloss, which can sometimes take a little while to grow, and foxglove as well.
Mm-hmm.
So they're kind of really nice, big, tall. They're really stunning.
Well, they're biennials, aren't they? So they tend to grow, germinate in the first year and produce this big rosette of foliage. Then in the second year, they create blooms.
Yeah.
But that's brilliant, because then you've got some things that bloom in the first year and some in the second.
Yeah.
Even more longevity.
And Birdsfoot Trefoil, which I found works really nicely in hanging baskets, because it kind of hangs over. So as
I've never done
such
that.
A cool idea.
It's a really nice idea.
Yeah, it looks really good. Yeah.
So look, I mean, lots of these can be grown in containers and baskets as well, can't they?
Massively. So. The main thing with containers and baskets is just not to put too many balls in. It's quite tempting sometimes in a small, you know, to, put quite a few. Yeah. You don't need many really.
Yeah. Because each ball's got so many seeds in it, you would, you know, you wouldn't plant more than however many, you know, plants in a basket. So don't go mad with seed balls, basically.
Yeah. I think we suggest about like 10 to 20 centimeters between each ball.
Right. Okay.
And over time, as the clay slowly kind of breaks down, it will kind of naturally disperse a little bit as well. So, they can kind of take over, but they're slow. So this is really the thing that is that. It's not a speedy result. Mm. Kind of their native wildflowers are naturally quite slow to get going.
Worth the wait.
Yeah.
I think we tend to be conditioned sometimes that wildflowers are difficult to establish and grow, but that's not necessarily the case with the support of seed ball, because you've obviously got that protective coating, you've got the clay, you've already got the soil there for them to grow in. So I love the concept. But I want to touch on another couple of mixes you've got that are very interesting to me. So first of all, you've got a shade mix, haven't you? Because it's difficult to establish plants in those dark, shady corners of our gardens or patios. So what is in your shade mix? What components do you have?
So we have...
She's grabbed a seed ball. What do we have in that
mix?
We've
got so many mixes. I get confused between them all. So it's Red Campion, Ragged Robin, which is, I don't know if you've seen it, it's
beautiful.
It's really beautiful.
Yeah, it's gorgeous.
Pink.
Bellflower, which looks a lot like bluebells. In fact, I'd love to have bluebells, but they take so long to germinate that it's... Meadow Buttercup, Meadow Sweet, Forget Me Not, and Oxide Daisy. Now, if it's in a really, really dark spot, it might still kind of struggle. The idea is it's kind of partial shade.
The
so
best
a
chance
bit
of success, isn't it, with this mix?
Yeah.
And then one other mix that I find very interesting is the bat mix.
Yep.
Of course, bats often overlooked in attracting them to the garden. But what is in our bat mix there? Some night-scented flowers as well.
Yeah, so the idea is that it's kind of all attracting moths in the evening, so it's kind of flowers that you will still have a scent in the evening as the sun's setting. So it's night-scented stock and wallflower, primrose, borage, my favourite, which is cornflower.
Mm, oh, pretty.
Yes. I love it. And corn marigold.
That's a lovely mix. And a lovely mix of colours as well, so you've got oranges and pinks.
Yeah. Yeah, with this one we donate a little bit of something to the Natural History Museum. They have the scientists at the Natural History Museum helped us to develop the mix.
That's brilliant. I've seen your range really grow over the last few years, and you've got a lot of specialist tubs as well. But you've also got one with Plant Life.
Yes,
I think it's worth telling us where your link up with Plant Life. What happens there?
So with Plant Life, we were aware that they're pretty much doing something that we would love to be able to do in the future too. So they actually own and manage their own wildflower reserves. They're like the kind of leading conservation organisation for wildflowers.
I see.
And given that what we're trying to do is all about inspiring people to grow wildflowers in their gardens, it kind of made sense for us to, like, we believe in connections and networking and kind of like it's about working together to kind of solve some of these issues. So with the Plant Life, we actually, for sales from Plant Life, we donate from every sale to the Greenamore Reserve that's in Cornwall. Mm-hmm. I think it's Cornwall. So it's kind of directly contributing to one of their wildflower reserves. I mean, I'd love to have that, you know, in the future. Could you imagine kind of owning like huge areas of land that you manage for wildflowers? That must be amazing. They have a fantastic road verge campaign. Yeah, it's about managing road verges for wildflowers instead of kind of some of the heavy management that councils do. So we try and kind of poke people that way a lot as well, because they're a pretty impressive organisation. But yeah, and because we just want people to, you know, have access to the most amount of information as possible. Mm. And we, you know, we can kind of, you know, we're the seed ball experts, but you know, it's good to connect people to other cool stuff.
Mm. Link people up.
Collaboration is key.
Yeah.
Massive.
Yeah. So and people can find out more with the hashtag Nomo.
Hashtag Nomo. Yeah.
Okay.
That's super cool.
I love seeing roadside verges.
It's amazing.
Just full
it?
Of beautiful flowers. It always saddens me, you know, if you go by a week later and it's all been chopped back.
And it's actually cheaper for councils to manage it that way in a lot of ways. It's, you know, you don't need so many, all these kind of spraying that they kind of do to try and keep weeds down and stuff. If they manage it for wildflowers, it's actually a lot easier for them to do it. It's just about, you know, having programs that can help work with the councils to implement it. But one of the major issues for like bees and butterflies is habitat fragmentation. So actually road verges, these long kind of like roads with a long wildflower, distance of wildflowers. My English is really bad.
But like an unbroken stream of wild blooms is better for butterfly.
It's better for all, biodiversity, because you're linking up different habitats. Uh-huh. So the problem, one of the biggest issues for our wildlife is all these broken bits of habitat, so habitat fragmentation.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes these long roads that...
It's like a highway.
Exactly, yeah.
I'm in a village near where I live called Philby. They have a bee highway. So they have all these raised beds that start kind of along the main road, and then they go around a country lane, and they're all full of plants that, you know, bees love. And they call it the bee highway, which is really cool. So they've got these places to go to.
I love this kind of stuff. And the more people we can work with that are doing these kind of things.
So when we
make the seed balls, we often get ones that are a bit funny shaped that we can't use in the tins.
Uh-huh.
So if there's kind of like community groups that are looking to do these kind of things, then we will help out with seeds and stuff.
So where can we get the seed balls from then? Stockists and your website?
Yeah, a lot of our time we're working with retailers, so we sell them mostly to retailers. We work with some really, really cool, fun people. We're in Kew Gardens and places like that, which is really cool. And they're on our website.
You can get some in garden centres, can't you? I've seen them around. I see them sometimes at kind of garden fairs, and I've even seen them in village shows, you know, things like that, where there's stands on the village green and there's seed balls. I see them frequently.
They're a great gift, aren't they?
Yeah.
Because they've got that kind of lovely tin, and they've got really lovely design too.
Yeah, we spent a lot of time trying to make it look like something that's kind of... that's got a design element to it.
Yeah,
yeah. And for stocking fillers, I think it's always, or Mother's Day, things like that, it works really nicely. And the tin, it's got something about a tin.
Yeah,
I don't know what it is. Yeah, and definitely. People tend to use them as a keepsake and kind of keep
them. Yeah, you can reuse them.
Of course,
it works. It works really nicely. But we're delighted. We get such nice, people say such nice things to us.
And where can we find you on social media?
So it's at @seed_ball, and that's on Twitter and Instagram. I think on Facebook we're Seedball HQ.
Okay. I'm sure you'll be very easy to find.
We hang out there.
Just type in Seedball.
Hanging out on social media so much. And because essentially everything that we've done and everything that we were trying to go, it's all about it's connecting with people, connecting with people online and stuff. And so we love it. It's amazing.
Beautiful. Well, I think you're going to connect with a lot more people out there.
Yeah,
so thank you very much.
Yeah, really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Thank you so much. It's really cool to be part of
this. I'm going to go and scatter my bat seed balls.
Amazing.
La, 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 la. You wanted me to start, but I'm too shy.
Oh, my goodness.
I was shy once, you know.
Were you?
Yeah, like, well, in this week's gossip, we're going to talk about public speaking and what that's like. But there was a time when I would not have imagined getting up and talking in front of an audience.
What
it must
change?
Be the same for you, or not? Or were you always
I've just always been like
really?
This.
So you were at school then? Or?
Yeah, I think
that's
so.
Pretty unique for an English kid, isn't it?
I think I used to get far more nervous than I do now.
Uh-huh.
I'd probably get quite anxious about it, but I would still do it. Yeah, but I think I would probably always do it. But I'd be much
tired of that at school.
More nervous about doing it.
Sometimes,
but what changed for you? When did you become okay with public speaking?
I don't know if I've ever told you this like deep story before, Ellen.
No, probably not.
When I look back, I'm a completely different person to what I was, because at school I was very shy and kind of mousy, and in my teenage years, kind of around 12-13, like, you know, all the other kids, their voices are breaking, and it's kind of, you know, obviously sorting itself out. It's embarrassing maybe for a few weeks, it's all a bit squeaky for a bit, but kind of I was in a situation where my voice kind of went to a squeaky, but it never then settled into like a kind of grown-up voice, which was very a real paranoia factor for me. Well, until I was probably 20.
Oh, okay.
Honestly, yeah.
Right, okay.
And so this was super embarrassing, and obviously, especially like in gym class or something. Sorry, I'm so Americanized.
In PE gym class.
PE class. Yeah, to, like, you know, call out your name or answer the register. It was so embarrassing. In a French class, I used to bunk off because I didn't want to be speaking out, you know. And obviously that made me more nervous to then address it and find out what was going on. And, yeah, and so it was kind of not at all normal, my voice at that stage, and I didn't really understand it. And it wasn't until I was 20 and I think a friend of mine, somehow I managed to find the confidence to talk about this subject, because it also was a real taboo and nobody ever talked to me about it because they were kind of, oh, we're not going to mention that, blah, blah, blah. And yeah, and I then, I think, went through the doctor and went for speech therapy, but it actually then took almost a year of speech therapy to then make it into the proper voice that it should be, because I psychologically wasn't letting it appear for some
reason. Like you were holding it in?
Yeah, I was almost holding myself for puberty, perhaps. I don't really know. It's all very strange, and I probably don't understand it fully
now.
You've
come so far,
exactly,
then.
Because if I then think back to that, you know, 14-year-old boy in home economics class, you know, with people taking the piss in some ways as well, and now, you know, doing TV, radio and whatever, and then also the thing I find strange is when people say, oh, I love your voice. Yeah. I'm like, how could you? I've always hated it. It's like, oh my gosh. And
but your voice is fabulous.
I know. Now I kind of...
Now you just
coming
don't
round
stop
to
talking.
It, but, yeah, so this is a very long story to get to the fact that I've grown into public speaking. And it was still the first few years of being at Thompson Morgan from, you know, 18 to almost like, it wasn't until 25 that I perhaps went out on the road and did some public speaking. And the first few times you're so nervous, yeah, and kind of standing up and talking to a load of people is just so difficult.
It is difficult. Yeah. It's one of those funny...
I don't find that now, though. Do you?
No, I enjoy it, actually. Yeah, I thoroughly enjoy it. It's not without slight nerves, because I think that's a good thing. You've just channeled them in the right way. But it's a funny experience, though, isn't it?
Doesn't make you more nervous if there's people you know in the audience, though?
It's worse, way worse, if there's some people who I know.
Because in a way, it should be more comfortable that you know people in the audience, because it's familiar.
I don't know the answer to that.
Strange, isn't it?
But yeah, that's always the case. I always feel more nervous if there's people who I know, family and friends probably more so.
Yeah.
I don't know why that is. What was the first public talk you ever done?
I'm not officially sure, but I think it might be a gun club near Stowmarket, and my boss, who kind of pushed and encouraged me into these things, so I really, even though it was annoying at the time, I really thank him for that now. And yeah, it was a gun club, and I remember I took a bowl of hellebores. That's not even relevant to what I'm about to tell you, but anyway. and I just remember being super nervous, but getting through it, and obviously having that proper PowerPoint as well helps you through that too. But
he must have been so proud, though, to have got to that point and done it.
Yeah, I guess it's not until a few times down the line that you feel proud, because the first few times you're like, oh my God, that was horrible, I don't want to do it ever again. And but it is, there's a few kind of tips to success that I would give now, as you probably would, Ellen Mary. One is, no, actually two, they kind of roll into one. It kind of almost makes them ambassadors in the audience before you start public speaking. So have a little chit-chat with a few people, ideally people that are on the front row. So it kind of then makes you a little bit more... Yeah, they warm up
and
stuff.
You're warming up,
Because actually what you're warming them up for is your jokes, and making sure someone laughs at any jokes that are in the
presentation. I almost always ask a question first.
Yeah.
One of the first things I do will... ask a question or say something that connects with what's going on that day.
What, do you expect people to answer out loud or just nod?
No, just like something for them to go, okay. Oh, yeah, I understand that. Oh, yeah, I appreciate that. Oh, yeah, that did happen today. Or, you know, that kind of thing.
So that familiarity for them and for you.
Yeah, because it's also for them, you know. It can be, it's probably quite hard maybe sitting and watching somebody. I don't know.
Yeah, but do you have that thing where you're like watching the audience? You always pinpoint one certain person. I've got no idea why. No idea why. It's not even for any reason, but somehow your eyes are always going back to them.
Mm-hmm.
And worse still, it could be the person that is always, like, either asleep, nodding off, or looking completely
disinterested. Yeah, and that's really off-putting. And there's a time that happened that it's just the one time I can really remember. There was a young lady who was sitting in the audience.
A young lady.
And she was listening to my Plants for Women's Wellbeing talk.
Mm-hmm.
And she was kind of down in her chair, slouching.
arms are folded.
Probably didn't want chin, you to ask her a question.
Chin was tucked in. She kind of was looking at me as if to say, this is really boring and my mate's drags me here. And it is quite off-putting when you're talking. You have to try and avoid looking at them, but then you can't help it. You're just drawn to that person. And at the end, she came over and she was so enthusiastic. She said, that was so good. I really enjoyed it. When I go home, I'm going to try this, this, and this. So you never really know what's going on inside. People can't always smile at what you're doing.
Well, yeah, when you're in an audience, do you sit there smiling?
No, exactly. You'd get face ache, wouldn't you? But I do have one tip. It's the reverse of a tip, and that's
it's not that naked thing, is it?
Yes, because somebody always told me to look at people as though they're naked. Never do that.
Oh.
Never do it.
Right.
That is the most.
They were naked, or what?
No, but they weren't naked. But someone said, if you're concerned, that's not what I was imagining. Yeah. Look at everybody as though they're naked, okay? And I did that. It didn't last very long because as soon as I'd done that, I was totally thrown.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh.
Why would I want to imagine everybody naked?
Yeah, I don't know.
So that piece of advice has never, ever worked for me.
Uh-huh. What about when you... Because obviously you do a bit of TV as well.
Yeah.
What about that? How do you find that?
Totally different. It's totally different.
In a better way or worse way?
Well, it's easier because you're not... If it's not live TV, if you're just recording, then you can do it over and over again if you really need to. I mean, professionally, you don't want to do that.
You've
also
got to perform to camera, which not a lot of people would like to do.
You're just looking at a camera, though, aren't you?
Yeah.
So you're not getting that feedback from people. So you're not catching people's eyes if you like someone looking disinterested or, someone crying. Not that anyone's crying. But, you're not getting that interaction, I suppose. So I find that much, much easier.
Mm-hmm.
I love people. So I love doing the talks when people are there.
That's cool. What's the weirdest place you ever did a talk then? Or most unusual
place?
I did one in a church once. That's not that unusual.
No, I don't think I've done one anywhere unusual.
Mm. Actually, garden talks don't tend to be in unusual spots. It's not like it's on the edge of a cliff or something.
No, my goodness. No, I've never done one in an unusual place.
What about weirdest questions and stuff?
Oh, okay.
You said you had a question.
I've got one. Okay. Yeah. So I'm going to attempt to tell you this sensitively. I was doing a talk at Bloom in the Park in Dublin.
Bloom?
And it was plants for well-being. So what plants you could grow for common illnesses and then what you would do with them.
Oh, I know this. I know what
and it was geared a bit more towards women, but there were men in the audience. So I realised... as I was going through the talk that I needed to just cater a little bit more for the men in the audience too. And at the end, I had such good feedback and one chap came over and he was telling me all about his farm and how they're now growing different herbs and stuff and it was all fabulous. And there was a queue of people. So this guy went off and another guy came forward and he said to me, bear in mind I was in Ireland, he had a really deep Irish accent, okay? And he said to me, and I said, oh, I'm really sorry. Could you say that again? Because I couldn't catch with the accent. And he said, I can't do the accent. Now, I really want to do it in an Irish accent. And he said to me, in his very deep Irish accent, do you know what I can take for impotence?
Uh-huh.
But because I had asked him to say it again and there was loads of people around, he said it really loudly.
Well, we shouldn't be embarrassed about that stuff.
I don't know that he was embarrassed. And, I'm not a herbalist, so I gave him some ideas, but I did say he should go to see his doctor or go to the local health food shop.
Yeah.
And so that was probably the trickiest question that I've ever been asked.
I'm not sure I ever... I've had one. I really, it's so annoying when someone's like, oh, this has happened to my plant. It's like, well, don't ask me why your plant died, which is on a t-shirt, I might say. Do you want a discount code? Ask me later. but it's so annoying when someone's like,
you never stop.
I've got this plant with yellow leaves. What's wrong with it? And it's like, they somehow feel like we are, I don't know, magicians with plants. And that can be a bit boring, but when I used to do talks when I was working for Mail Order Plant Company, I used to say at the end, you can ask me any questions, but any complaints, then you can ask them as I drive away.
You are expected to know everything.
I know, it's just, yeah. It's hard though, isn't it? I don't, but people do expect horticulturists to know everything.
And,
yeah.
And we don't.
No, we don't. We certainly don't.
The Plant-Based Podcast is sponsored by Sutton's, suppliers of gardeners' favourite products since 1806. Unsurprisingly, Sutton's now have everything you need for your outside space. Award-winning flower and vegetable plants, garden furniture and equipment, plus gifts for gardeners. Visit them online at suttons.co.uk.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Plant-Based Podcast.
Have a browse of the rest of the library or hop on over to the website, which is theplantbasedpodcast.net.
You'll also find our social media links. Please connect with us and let us know about any plant-based projects that you think we should be covering on the show.
And make sure you subscribe to our podcast so you'll be the first to hear the next episode. We're releasing once a fortnight. So until next time, enjoy the world of plants.